Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Audrey Niffenegger, whose latest novel is Her Fearful Symmetry. Earlier novel, The Time Traveler's Wife. Audrey Niffenegger is an artist, graphic artist, has a graphic novel coming out, I guess, later this year, makes prints, teaches art, and we'll go into all of that in a little bit because you've now begun this career as a major novelist, and it's different from what you've been doing in the past. So let me start there. What prompted you to move from the direction of graphic work into novels? And I understand you originally thought of Time Traveler's Wife as a graphic novel.
I managed to hold that thought for about 45 minutes until I really considered it and realized that it would be almost impossible to depict somebody popping in and out of different time frames. I mean, comics could maybe do it, but not the kind of books that I was doing.
Well, what kind of books were you doing?
Aquatints, with a little bit of text, set letterpress, and I was producing them myself in editions of 10. They were very, very nicely produced, but it wasn't exactly the way to get your work seen by a lot of people.
And The Time Traveler's Wife, how did you come on the idea? I mean, there have been many, many novels and stories about time travel. What brought you to this particular story and your decision to actually write the book?
The first bit of the idea was actually the title itself, which fortunately gives one two characters and their relationship and the fact that the husband's a time traveler. And when I first thought of that, I thought, well, it would be kind of a drag to be the wife. She would spend a lot of time wondering what was going on and being left behind. And as I started to think about it, I had this visual image, which actually became the very last scene in the book. And for people who haven't read it, I won't say what that was. But the image was enough to propel me to want to figure out how this woman had gotten to that place. And so I started to try to figure out who these people were and what had happened.
Did you figure out the entire timeline before you began writing it then?
No, not at all. No, I started by writing the last two scenes in the book, and then I wrote the scene where Claire, the wife, loses her virginity on her 18th birthday. And I think then I wrote the scene where Henry, as a five-year-old, time travels to the Field Museum in Chicago. So I was just jumping around. I'm complete chaos as a writer. I don't have a method that I can communicate to anyone.
At what point did you kind of realize that all of these little pieces actually would work? Or did you know that from the start?
I just had a good feeling about it. I was interested. I wanted to know what happened. And that is really all it takes to get yourself to sit there day after day and work on it.
Had you read much science fiction over the years?
Oh, yeah, sure.
So you were grounded in Heinlein's stories and all of, you know, Star Trek and everything?
I'm a lot more old school. I mean, I hesitate to admit it, but I have seen almost no Star Trek at all. So I was a big fan of people like H.G. Wells.
The book itself, when you finally pulled it together, you sent it out, and it was published by McAdam Cage in 2003. And that was great because you'd finally been published. But something happened in the interim. Now, was it when it came out in paperback, it suddenly became a cult item and a huge bestseller?
Well, McAdam Cage and I were lucky because it was chosen for the Today Show Book Club by Scott Turow. That happened a couple of weeks after it came out. So actually, McAdam Cage was able to share in the enhanced sales. And they were great. I had such a good time being published by them.
And then it came out in paperback and just absolutely took off.
Yeah. I mean, TV is probably the best thing that can happen to a book. It's kind of ironic.
And you said before you went on the air you never did see the movie.
No, I haven't. Partially to protect the funny little movie I have in my head. When you're reading, you make your own movie. I suppose if we could somehow manifest these movies and look at each other's movies from the same book, we would all be a little surprised. We'd say, oh, it's not like that. What are you doing? I feel sorry a little bit for filmmakers who adapt books, especially if the books are popular, because the filmmakers are never going to manifest what everybody has in their heads, and they're going to have to use actual humans to be the characters. And in my case, a book that was mostly set in Chicago got filmed in Toronto, so for me that wouldn't have satisfied my deep attachment to these places. And so after a while, it just dawned on me that, in fact, it might be better if I just kind of let the filmmakers get on with it and just didn't see it.
And you had nothing whatsoever to do with the film then either?
No, no control at all.
At what point did you begin work on your new book, Audrey Niffenegger, Her Fearful Symmetry. Was that around the time it got published, Time Traveler's Wife got published, afterward, that you knew that you would go into the area of ghost story?
I started Fearful Symmetry about a month before I finished Time Traveler, but I didn't know it was going to be a ghost story until I had been working on it for about 2 years. So there was a lot of muddling around at first.
Well, let's go back to that. The story itself revolves around Highgate Cemetery in London, and it would seem to me that that would have been the origin, and everything kind of branched out from that. Is that correct?
The actual origin was the idea of a man who never leaves his apartment and
really?
A young girl who comes and visits him. And so at the very beginning, what I had was this man in this dark apartment full of boxes and this young girl who, at first, I didn't know what their relationship was. I didn't know if she was his daughter or what. In my mind, this apartment was on the edge of a cemetery called Graceland in Chicago, in a neighborhood called Uptown, which is a kind of funky, little bit downtrodden neighborhood, but very cool. And I didn't know what I would do with a cemetery or why there needed to be one, but once there was one, I thought, well, is that the optimal cemetery? It occurred to me that I could try to do it in Highgate, and then the whole thing suddenly moved over to London. And since I've never lived in London, I thought, well, that's going to be a crazy, amazing research challenge. A few months later, I finally got up the nerve to actually phone the cemetery and got put through to Mrs. Jean Pateman, who at the time and until recently was the chairman of the charity group that runs the place. And part of Jean's job is discouraging annoying people who phone up and want to do things at the cemetery.
Kind of like the character Jessica.
Jean is the basis for Jessica.
Okay.
Yeah, and gave me permission to base that character on her. But the first few conversations we had weren't very promising, but eventually she decided I was okay and let me hang around.
So you flew out there. Now, what was it about Highgate that drew you to Highgate and made you go, okay, not Chicago, London?
I had been to London in 1996, and I had taken the tour, because you have to, if you want to go in that cemetery at all, half of it, you have to go on the tour. And I had taken the tour, and I don't remember a thing about the tour itself. I don't remember who my guide was or what they said or any of it, but I just remember looking at the place and being so blown away, because it's a Victorian cemetery. It's incredibly crowded. Some of the monuments are just astonishing. But at a certain point around the middle of the 20th century, nature started to just take over, and it's no longer the prim, tidy thing that it was designed to be. And so it's like a cemetery inside a jungle, and it's fantastic.
The characters in Her Fearful Symmetry live in a place called Ventravers. Did you find a place like that? I mean, did you see a building that resembled that?
No, it's a car park. Just built it out of imagination. And a friend of mine who's an architect actually made me a floor plan for it, so it exists on a piece of paper as a diagram.
It's very strange for me, because I'm looking at you, and in my mind, the character of Elspeth kind of looked like you, and I'm not quite sure what that's about.
Well, Elspeth kind of started as a self-portrait, but it became obvious to me even at the beginning that she was a monster. She was going to be a bigger and bigger monster as the book went on.
There are many different areas in the book. I mean, it's a ghost story, but it's a ghost story about obsessive-compulsive disorder, about the nature of twins, and also a little bit about cemeteries and living in a cemetery. So let's continue on with this journey through the origins of this story. Okay, you've got the cemetery now.
Mm-hmm.
You've searched through it. You've got the imaginary building transplanted from Chicago and moved into a car park. And you've got a man sitting in an apartment and a girl. What came next?
The girl, whose name by then was Julia, had this very annoying roommate. And the roommate's name was Valentina. And I just couldn't stand her. I was just like, I don't want to do anything with you. You're so deeply annoying. And so I just kind of squished her up and threw her away and replaced her with another girl named Valentina, who suddenly became Julia's twin. I mean, one thing I can say about writing is that it's always a little difficult to explain why you do certain things. Half the time you're just grabbing stuff out of air, and it's so because you say it's so. It's like being a little kid, and, you know, you just say, okay, now she's going to fly, and it is the case because you say so. And so a lot of these things at the primal stew stage of the novel are decisions that were made, and you just thought to yourself, okay, yeah, that's right. And not because it was logically right, but because it was just intuitively right.
Is there any difference in that in, say, working on your artwork?
No, it's the same with the art. Yeah, I mean, you're groping around, and then there's this sudden feeling of certainty. But once I had a pair of twins, I realized that that was not just... It wasn't just true for these two characters that they were twins, but it could also be true for the novel, that everything could be based on doubling and twinning and opposites. And so it started to become a structural device that made not only more characters, but that made plot.
And at what point did Edie and Elspeth, the parent twins, if you want to call them that, at what point did they show up?
Fairly early on in a dim sort of way, because the neighborhood around the cemetery is really wealthy. And there was no way that two 21-year-olds were just going to prance into that neighborhood and have a flat. There's not very much in the way of affordable housing around there. I had been rummaging around in the grab bag of 19th-century English novel cliches, and I thought, okay, they have an inheritance. They're there because they have a rich relative, and they've inherited this stupendous flat. So they suddenly acquired an aunt out of nowhere. And then, just because I'm into excess, I gave the aunt a twin who was their mother. And so the doubling of the doubles started to happen until you can... It's sort of like standing in between two mirrors and starting to get a little giddy. But I think partially what happened to make it a ghost story was that once I had this dead aunt, I started to think about what she was like as a person. And I just was very attracted to her. I mean, I thought she was just fun. And I was really sorry that I had killed her before she even came into being. Then I thought, well, you know, it would have been fun to write her. It's just too bad she's gone. And then I thought, okay, you know, she's a ghost. So it was a semi-logical process.
good way to keep a character around.
Yeah. But I mean, I think a lot of people perhaps read it with this idea of, oh, you know, she's just into the supernatural. And it actually started at the beginning as this way of thinking about obsessive compulsive disorder.
So now you've got the ghost, and we're still missing the character who is probably the most important character in the book, the guy who we identify with because he's observing the whole thing, and that's Robert,
mm-hmm.
the boyfriend. And at what point did he suddenly arrive?
Because I had Martin needed a mirror or an opposite, and so I thought, okay, so Elspeth had a lover, and in my very contrived little world, all these people live in the same apartment building. So Robert lives on the ground floor, and he is a tour guide at the cemetery, as well as being a PhD student who's writing his thesis on the cemetery. And so he's very wrapped up in this Victorian world of the dead. But he's also just a matter-of-fact guy, and he's always a little confused. He's always a little bit behind what all the other characters are thinking.
Now you begin to put it together, okay, and you begin to write the story. When you're writing the story, do you know where you are? Have you been, you know, taking those six-month walks, or are you sitting down going, oh, God, what happens next? How do I pull it together now?
I seem to be a person who never exactly knows where the story begins. And so what happened was I had this notion that real novelists would start at the beginning and write through to the end. And so I started at what I thought was the beginning, which was the twins getting off of an airplane and stepping into Heathrow Airport and going to their flat. And I had gotten the voice all wrong, and it was kind of... It was like a bad puppet that you can't do anything with, and it just kind of staggers along. And so it just took me a long time to find the voice and also to figure out how to move through the minds of all these different characters fluidly, because there's 10 point of view characters. So I was sort of lurching about doing all of that and just trying to get some technique under control. And while that was happening, the story was sort of slowly clicking into place like a little Rubik's Cube. I didn't actually know what the climax of the book was until I'd been working on the thing for 5 years.
When you say that the climax, does that mean that entire business starting with the cat?
Yes. The cat was actually the clue that led me to eventually take the whole thing there. I wrote that scene without knowing what it was going
to
be.
You're listening to an interview with Audrey Niffenegger, whose latest novel is Her Fearful Symmetry. Characters make decisions, and those decisions they make are kind of out there, which means it's your job to ensure that those decisions follow logically. And in terms of that, did you have problems with that, or did you just kind of let it go?
There are some characters who get really wiggy, and when you're watching a real live person kind of lose their mind, it's hard enough to try to empathize with what's going on with a real person. In a book, you can actually get right into that character's mind. What I was hoping to do was to show you a process that was so incremental that by the time the truly strange stuff started to happen, you would actually say, okay, I can understand that the character might actually decide to do that.
Did you do any research whatsoever into parapsychology or OCD?
I had previously done tons of research on the spiritualist movement because I had done an entire exhibition of artwork about seances and stage magic and all that kind of thing. So I had a background in that. The OCD, I had a friend who had it rather badly and who also was very insightful about it and who was able to explain to me a lot of what he was going through.
And the drug that Martin can take that can get him away from the OCD, you did some research on that?
I researched that separately. Yeah, that had nothing to do with my friend.
He's a crossword puzzle maker. Where did that come in?
Oh, you know, I was looking for things he could do at home and trying to find things that would suit him, that would just be really good for that particular kind of mind that he has. And I thought, yeah, crossword puzzle setting, that would be perfect, because there's these British cryptic crosswords that are just, oh, my God. And I thought, yeah, he just makes those. That's just how his mind works.
One thing I find interesting, comparing the two books, there was an article, Audrey Niffenegger, in Slate magazine about the physics behind Time Traveler's Wife. And one of the elements of that article was the insistence that there's no free will. It's all mapped out. I mean, no matter what you do in the present and in the future and you go back and all, it's all going to be there anyway. And yet, her fearful symmetry seems to be the complete opposite of that. They all have free will, or at least some of them seem to have a certain amount of free will. I don't know. I mean, was any of that in your mind at all?
I think about that a lot. In Time Traveler, Henry actually says at some point that you have free will in the present. Wherever you happen to be, you're always in the present, and you can act. My intention was not, in Time Traveler, to present a completely deterministic universe, but to get people to think about it. And even though Henry's being flung around, he's still always in his own present. On the other hand, there's ample evidence, you know, for him that he isn't going to be able to change stuff that he either knows about or has already experienced. In this particular book, yeah, the characters are willful as all get out and are constantly exercising that will. Elsbeth, of course, is the willful est.
Yeah, and she takes many, many turns. As you said before, she kind of becomes monstrous, but she isn't at first.
No. I love her very much. I've been getting a lot of feedback from people who come to readings who hesitantly say, you know, well, we didn't like all the characters. And I'm like, that's great. You're not supposed to. I'm relieved. If you would worry me if you liked all the characters.
Is there any character that you particularly like? I mean, Robert comes off as the best, I guess. Though Valentina comes off pretty well, too.
The characters are all changing, with the exception of Jessica and James, who are almost like a Greek chorus. They're there to be a kind of moral sounding board. Robert is a little passive when the book starts off and is letting people boss him around a bit. Valentina is being bossed around, but she resents it and is trying to get out from under. Julia is incredibly bossy, and so her journey is to let up on that. And everybody's got some things they need to learn, and they do, because this is my 21st century version of a 19th century novel, and so everybody gets what they deserve.
When you're done with that first draft, I mean, first draft, we're talking about computers, so you change things all along. How hard was it to go back and create consistency in either book?
What's kind of bizarre about my writing method is that rather than moving through an entire first draft and then going back and rewriting, what I actually do is I begin a scene and work on it until it is quite done. And other than tweaking little things for continuity, I probably won't touch it again until it's time to edit with my editors. So it's more like making a wall full of bricks and putting everything in place. And it's hard for me sometimes to retrofit. I mean, sometimes I do need to do that. Once I've done working on them and take my hand off of it, it's very hard for me to go back in.
So pretty much when you figured out the climax, that was going to be the climax. There were no other alternatives. That was going to be it.
Originally, when I thought of it, it was going to turn out differently.
Really?
Yeah. And then all of a sudden I thought of that extra turn, and I was like, that's what has to happen, because that's what these people would do.
The book ends with a conclusion to each separate story of each separate character, and you're very happy with each of those.
I am. I'm really committed with the way that things have worked out for each character. I feel when I was writing it, I definitely had that sense of completion that you get when you know you're there and it seems right for the characters.
And how did you know the book was done? How did you know that you could just send it off?
The whole time I'm working on something, it's almost like a radio station in my head. I mean, there's this kind of ongoing space in my brain that's devoted to these characters doing things and saying things and thinking about things. And typically I'll be noodling around with a particular scene or some plot problem, and it just accompanies you wherever I am. I would be with the characters. And I know I'm done when everybody just gets really quiet and there's no more problems to work on and everything kind of comes to rest. And people say, oh, well, aren't you going to write a sequel? And I'm like, no, you know, they're all quiet in there. There's nobody talking.
Unless someone starts talking down the road, and you don't know that.
Yeah, but, you know, there's this new group of characters that I am now boogieing with.
And we'll get to that in a minute. But first, Audrey Niffenegger, let's go back and talk a little about your career, because it's an interesting one. You are an expert at making prints.
I have been a printmaker since I was 15. And I do all these really archaic things. I set type by hand. I make aquatints, all this stuff that seems to be fading from our collective lexicon. But anyway, yeah, I make books by hand.
And 1995, you and others formed the Columbia College Chicago Center for Book and Paper Arts. What is that?
It is a part of Columbia College in Chicago which teaches people how to make books. The people who are running it now have taken it in a much more conceptual direction, and so they're offering things now like offset printing and some very theoretical classes that we didn't used to have. But we're still doing the same stuff that we've always done, so there's papermaking, there's handbook binding, there's artist books and letterpress.
Well, what do you think about what's happening to the entire world of print these days?
I have this strange mix of hope and excitement and despair. The whole notion of an e-reader is fantastic, and I think artists could do a lot with it. And there could be special new art form just for it, depending on what the tech side of it is like. It's fantastic for disabled people because you can enlarge the type and you don't need to use your hands. And anyway, there's a lot of good in them. It's kind of destroying publishing. And I think, you know, with Apple releasing their whole tablet thing, that may slow it or help it, depending on the business model that they work out with the magazine and newspaper people. But even in books, people are frightened. The publishers are very, very upset.
You teach writing courses that specialize in text-image relationships. What does that mean?
Well, sometimes it means something as familiar as a comic. Sometimes it means something like an installation piece or a sound, you know, sound getting together with books. Lots of cross-media stuff. Basically, we think about how you get the words and the images to work together and how that's different from words by themselves and images by themselves.
Are you comfortable with the field of graphic novels? I can't really get into it.
No?
No.
Really? You don't love it? See, I remember the first time I ever encountered Mouse was when it was being serialized in Raw, and I was about 19, and I'm like, what is that? That is different. It was like a light bulb going on. It was like those dreams where you open a door and there's this whole part of your house you didn't know about. It was
right.
Like that. Yeah, no, Art Spiegelman's really important to me. And there's been such masterpieces made. I mean, Chris Ware blows me away every time. So, yeah, I love it. It's great. Yeah, there's just so much now. I mean, it's just everywhere, every minute there's some amazing new thing coming. It's hard for one person to combine fantastic graphic abilities with really excellent writing. But you do find it, and when you get somebody who can do both or a team of people working together really well, it's just exquisite.
What is the Night Booksmobile?
The Night Bookmobile is a, I suppose you could say it's a graphic short story. I made it for the London Guardian, and you can see it if you go on their website. It's coming out as a book, gosh, I guess it is 2010 now, isn't it? It's coming out as a book this fall. It was about a young woman who's wandering around Chicago late at night and comes across this Winnebago camper, which she discovers is her own personal bookmobile that contains everything she's ever read. It's kind of my bizarro vision of the afterlife, essentially.
Audrey Neffenegger, your new book that you're working on now is The Chinchilla Girl in Exile.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about a girl covered in hair.
Yes, she has hypertrichosis. Isn't that an excellent word? She's growing up in Skokie, Illinois. The first bit of it has to do with her desire to go to school because she's been homeschooled because her family is afraid that she'll get teased. And she does indeed because children are kind of brutal that way.
And this is neither science fiction nor fantasy or don't you know yet?
I think it's closer to memoir. My days as a hirsute little girl. No, I... Not that I ever had that particular problem, but what I wanted to write about actually was what it's like to be different and just sort of the excruciating terrors of childhood.
You also have your artwork exhibited at the Prince Work Gallery in Chicago, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I hooked up with them in 1987, I believe it was. And they're marvelous. I mean, if anybody's in Chicago, you can walk into the gallery and they'll stop what they're doing and show you all kinds of great stuff.
Well, Audrey Neffenegger, you also studied at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, which meant that you could go into there all the time.
Well, they just opened a new wing, and my favorite bit of that museum has always been the Surrealist collection. They have an absolutely mind-blowing collection of various Surrealist things, particularly Joseph Cornell and people who have read my first book. There's a scene that's set in that room. And they recently relocated all that stuff, and so suddenly it's all installed differently, which is making me a little bit crazy, but the new wing is beautiful.
Listening to you, and you've worked in media that's old, that's new, combinations of media. You haven't worked, insofar as I know, in film, or have you?
No, I mean, when I was an art student, I got involved with a lot of other people's films, but no. Film is very collaborative, and I tend to gravitate toward things where I can do all the different bits myself.
So film or theater, because it's too collaborative, would probably not work for you?
Theater just terrifies me. I'm a terrible, terrible actress. I tried performance art for a while, and just it was not only the stage fright, but also the fact that you would do this thing, and it was completely evanescent. It would disappear as it was happening and exist only in the minds of the people who saw it. And I just wanted something that would be more tangible.
Now you're a successful novelist with two novels. How do you feel about, I mean, I know a number of people, when they have two different art forms that they're working on, wind up getting pulled in different directions, and it can sometimes be unnerving because something's drawing you back, particularly when you're really successful in it, financially successful. Do you feel any of that yet?
I've worked as a visual artist these, I don't know, 25 years or so, and it's unimaginable to me that I would stop. So even if I had no deadlines, even if I had no shows and nobody cared, I would still make the art. I'm lucky because I have a gallery who likes to give me shows and people who have followed my art for a very long time who collect it. So that's really great. But mainly I do these things for myself, and if you can't be by yourself in the studio playing, it doesn't turn out very well. For me, the big trick is to kind of forget, you know, who wants what and what people expect and all that sort of thing, and just make stuff.
Whether it be a print or a book.
Yeah, absolutely. And not to put a value on things in money. With the second book, I didn't have a contract for it. It was so different in my mind from the first one that I didn't know if anybody would want it or if editors would like it or anything. So I just pleased myself, which was quite good. And then when I put it out there, I was lucky because I got a deal, got a really good editor, and it all worked out.
And the title, Her Fearful Symmetry?
Comes from William Blake's poem, Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright in the Forest of the Night.
And what drew you to that title then?
This is so funny. It should be very romantic and ethereal, but actually it's pretty nuts and bolts. I was very envious and admiring of Philip Pullman's title for his trilogy, His Dark Materials, which of course comes from Milton. And I just like the way that's structured. There was something about it that really grabbed me. And when I stumbled across the Blake poem again for the 10,000th time, I thought, oh yeah, that would be perfect. You know, because already I had these mirror twins and I had all of this mirroring and opposites. And so you had the symmetry and it was a ghost story and it was just dropped into place like a jigsaw puzzle piece.
It sounds to me that happens a lot with you. Stuff just kind of falls into place.
Yeah. I think part of it is that because I've been working for a long time, because I have been following certain trains of thought for a long time, and because I trust in the process, I often feel like what I'm doing is I understand that there's an empty spot, and I just kind of hold out my hand and wait for the thing that fills the spot. And generally it comes, and if it doesn't, then I have to reformulate the problem.
You've been listening to an interview with Audrey Niffenegger, whose latest novel is Her Fearful Symmetry. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.